Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by House Speaker Pelosi that the House was ready to move forward with articles of impeachment, saying, quote, "The president leaves us no choice because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit." Harry Littman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, an executive producer and host of the podcast Talking Feds, who has an article at the Washington Post, "The Wait to See Trump's Taxes Just Got Longer," joins us. We will discuss the effectiveness of yesterday's testimony from the legal scholars and the dramatic press conference today at which Pelosi made her announcement. As she was leaving the press briefing, Speaker Pelosi had a confrontation with a right-wing propagandist from Sinclair Broadcasting, who parroted the Republican line that the impeachment is all about Democrats hating Trump. Pelosi returned to the podium and replied, quote, "This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I pray for the president all the time, so don't mess with me when it comes to words like that." Pelosi then strode away from the podium as the press corps erupted in a rare outburst of spontaneous applause. Then we will speak with James Stewart, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist at the New York Times, whose latest book just out is Deep State: Trump, the FBI, and the Rule of Law. On this dramatic day with the announcement that a third president of the United States will be impeached, we'll look into the behind-the-scenes stories of the firing of Comey and the beginning of the Mueller report, from which Trump learned nothing since the day after Mueller's underwhelming testimony. Trump, who clearly cares little about the rule of law, committed the act that has led to his impeachment. Then finally, we'll examine the uprisings against unpopular and unresponsive governments around the world, from Iran to Hong Kong, from Lebanon to Chile, and speak with Maria Victoria Murillo, a professor of political science and the director of the Institute for Latin American Studies at Columbia University. She joins us to discuss her article with Stephen Levitsky in Monday's New York Times, The Return of the Generals, which argues that in overlooking the tragic lessons of Latin America's dictatorial past, politicians are turning again to the armed forces to resolve crises. And joining us now is Harry Littman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and he's the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast, and he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Wait to See Trump's Taxes May Have Just Gotten a Lot Longer." Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Littman.
Thank you very much, Ian. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks, Harry. And today, of course, Nancy Pelosi ordered, if that's the right word, the House to proceed with articles of impeachment. So it's official that President Trump is being impeached.
Yes, if the vote it is official. And notwithstanding the Republican suggestions that this has all been a three-year quest and it was, you know, always a impeachment in search of a crime, if you remember, it wasn't very long ago that Pelosi, most prominent among others, was fairly skeptical, seemed to be leaning in the other direction. So things have moved awfully quickly since the discovery or the transmission of the whistleblower memo. And now the, you know, some previous skeptics have seen that, you know, there's really, as Professor Gerhardt said yesterday, if not this, if not now, then when? This, you know, the conduct that has been, I think, established beyond any reasonable doubt is so on the bullseye of what the impeachment remedy was given us for, but in two ways, really. The tinkering with, or not tinkering, the real consorting with foreign governments, and the elevation of Trump's personal interest over the interests of the country. This is things that the framers were most concerned about. And I don't think there's been as paradigmatic a case for impeachment literally in the nation's history.
So you mentioned yesterday's hearings. What did you think of the partisanship my belief is that the Republicans are deliberately injecting partisanship and overheated rhetoric in order to support their case that this is about partisanship. In other words, they're making right. their own case by being so partisan.
It's bootstrapping, yes.
Yeah.
So I agree. I don't even think it's controversial. I mean, when they came out of the box with these ridiculous parliamentary maneuvers meant to needle Nadler and kind of demean the proceedings, what else could they be doing? And this is after 2 weeks, of course, of denying facts that were within an inch of their face. In my view, they showed themselves impervious to facts over the last fortnight, and yesterday showed themselves impervious to law. It was a pretty compelling presentation by people who, notwithstanding again what the Republicans have suggested, were giving pretty mainstream academic views. But it was clear from the start that it was going to mean nothing. I think that the gamble or the reason that Nadler and Pelosi undertake it is that it actually it means something to the country. And you hearken back to what people remember, and I remember. I don't think I'm misremembering as a genuine kind of serious, sober, civic discourse in the Watergate years, and the partisanship now, even in the Clinton years, it seemed highly partisan, but the Democrats didn't pretend it was not happening or all illegitimate. So here we've really taken it to kind of hyperbolic levels where one whole side and one whole party is pretending there's nothing there when it's in front of their face. So, I agree that it's a manufactured charge of partisan or bootstrapping, I think would be a good way to put it. If they say it's partisan, then it sort of becomes partisan by definition.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast. And he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Wait to See Trump's Taxes May Have Just Gotten a Lot Longer." So Nancy Pelosi held a press conference today, and she went after a reporter from the right-wing propaganda outlet Sinclair Broadcasting. But I'll talk to you about that in a minute. I just wanted to mention what she said, which is when she was talking about going ahead with the impeachment, this has absolutely nothing to do with politics. It isn't about politics, partisanship, Democrats and Republicans. That's totally insignificant. It's about the Constitution of the United States, the oath of office we take to protect and defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's about the president not honoring his oath of office. So no, I'm not concerned. So she's sort of making it pretty clear. I'm not sure that the Republicans are listening or the supporters of Trump even paying attention. I think their minds have been made up. But so to what extent do you think Jerry Nadler, I don't think he's anything as effective as Adam Schiff. He chose the best legal professors you could find on the Constitution and on impeachment, but they were all fairly liberal, and the Republicans saw that as an opening and asked Pam Carlin about giving money to Democrats. And then the one that the Republicans chose, he went out of the gate making it clear that he didn't vote for Trump. So he was setting himself up as being nonpartisan. So do you think the Democrats fell into the partisanship trap in the sense of who they chose? I mean, there are a number of legal professors and legal scholars who are conservative who also oppose Trump.
Yeah. So the short answer is I don't think so, though there was, if not a trap, an inherent risk that it would just wash over people and just seem pointy-headed. But it's, in the world of the legal academy, and I do teach constitutional law, that is a left-leaning world without a doubt. But Feldman, Carlin, and Gerhardt are not radicals within them. And moreover, the nature of their opinions were very, you could say, conservative and conventional. They were originalist, which many conservatives insist on and state liberals don't do, and they were really anchored in the unassailable historical record of what the framers were concerned about. It was pretty clear from the back and forth that they were well practiced, and that the Dems, you know, that Nadler and Norm Eisen wanted to avoid a difficult moment. That is, you know, I think they could have worked with people who had a more of a middling pedigree, but they, you know, wanted to be able to control their 45 minutes and blitz through them, and that's why they had kind of friendly faces. But the opinions themselves were really pretty conventional. And as you say, Turley, who was not very coherent. I mean, he seemed to say that the conduct would be impeachable, but then suggest that maybe it hadn't been established because things had gone so quickly. You know, and I think that's just blinkers reality. So I thought all in all, the panel did a solid job and about the same kind of job that, you know, if they had switched out the personnel. But that job was preordained to be, you know, to have no purchase within in the Republican caucus. And would it in the American people? You know, things do seem so firmly polarized, and the people who are for Trump live or die don't seem to me to be ones whose scales will fall from their eyes because they hear a Harvard law professor say this or that. But I do think they need the testimony and the standard in order to build a case that goes to the Senate and they say, look, as so-and-so testified, you don't have to take it from us or this article. This is down the middle, front and center, why we have impeachment, and then go forward. Now, did they have to debut with it? You know, maybe not. But I don't think it was a bad day. I just don't think it was a very, you know, exciting one. And as you say, Nadler's a very different personality from Schiff, who was magnificent in those 2 weeks. And it's a, you know, these are very hard shoes for Nadler to try to fill.
Well, I think in a way that Nadler could have turned Turley's argument against him when Turley was basically saying, don't rush, you know, take your time, get the courts to rule on the subpoenas. I mean, a clever thing for Nadler to have said is, well, since you're speaking for the Republicans, they chose you, Jonathan Turley, maybe you can help us and get the Republicans to allow these key witnesses who would be ostensibly in defense of Donald Trump to testify, like the acting chief of staff and the secretary of state and so on. Do you think there was a missed opportunity there?
Yeah, look, you wouldn't have to say it to Turley. It's an overall opportunity that's still out there. It is an overall brazen one, too, isn't it, on the Republicans' behalf? Hey, it's all hearsay, which, by the way, you know, Clinton was entirely hearsay. I mean, that happens all the time. But hey, it's all hearsay on the one hand. On the other, oh no, we can't let anybody testify, which is itself, you know, I think impeachable conduct. You know, I don't think it would have gone anywhere to try to make the point to Turley. They need to sort of make it overall. And this, by the way, was something that Schiff did expertly, and maybe Nadler is, you know, along the same plan. Schiff used each witness to do what he wanted that witness to do, and then he tied it together daily in his closing arguments, and then at the very end in the report. So I don't think Nadler it necessarily needed to make this case through Turley, you know, but it's looming out there. And in fact, there seems to be significant sentiment within the caucus now to actually expand the putative third count, which is obstruction, to encompass some of the many instances that Mueller found. For example, the order to McGahn to fire Mueller, or the order to McGahn to falsify the order to fire Mueller, and you know, the like. So they are emphasizing that conduct more. And, you know, I think they just decided not to try to do too much through Turley, who again, he tried to be oddly sort of folksy, but at least in terms of, you know, analysis, it was very sort of, you know, muddled or weak, I thought.
So I mentioned earlier the press conference today where Nancy Pelosi was leaving, and a reporter for Sinclair, the right-wing outfit, was parroting the Republican talking point, saying, you know, this is all about the Democrats' hatred of Trump. And she really cleaned his clock.
Yeah.
And went back to the podium and said, this is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in the sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that. And of course, the entire press corps applauded her. So, I tell you, she's the best spokesperson for this whole thing.
But what about that, right? She is writing her own epitaph now in splendid fashion. You go back to a year ago, and was she too radical to be the speaker, and she only do it for one term? And she's really, you know, handled. She and Schiff have been quite the 1-2 punch. They've been, you know, really so dignified in a process that, where they're continually tempted to you know, go low, as it were, because the Republicans are not only being, you know, like circus animals here, but their points seem really silly. It's a critical, I think, it's critical not to take the bait and to respond with dignity as they have. This, you know, I go on different shows, including like Fox News, and this will come up all the time. This is portrayed among Trump partisans simply in terms of the political calculus. Well, the base hasn't changed, and these 10 Democrats won't want to vote. And I do find it, you know, really short-sighted. The stakes here are enormous any way you look at it, and it's irresponsible to be seeing this only in base political terms. I know that might be part of the equation, but for them to ignore the broader implications of the conduct here and not even try to say anything on the merits, it's just wrongheaded. You know, this is not a trivial episode, and the, you know, charges that have been laid out are grave as a heart attack. Any responsible leader needs to confront them.
Well, of course, it is their strategy to make it seem like a game, and they're using the president's own tactics of distraction by saying it's all about that the Dems wanted to get Trump from day one, and that obscures and obfuscates from the central fact of Trump's abuse of office. You had a recent piece in the Washington Post, the wait to see Trump's taxes may have just gotten a lot longer. And of course, today Trump appealed to the Supreme Court to overturn the appeals court ruling that he must turn over his taxes to the House. And there's, of course, another New York District Attorney's case. There's also the Supreme Court's got 3 cases now about Trump's taxes. It seems to me pretty clear that that is what Trump is most afraid of, is his taxes being released, and possibly because it might reveal Russian financing through Deutsche Bank. There's also the counterintelligence files that he's terrified about, and particularly the ones that started by Rod Rosenstein just after Trump fired Comey. That's been effectively buried by Barr. So compared to the possibility of the CIA file, which I think is a remote possibility, and the tax file coming out, how would you rate the strength of the case that's before the House now in terms of impeachment over the Ukraine call with Zelensky?
So I think yesterday put it well. It does seem paradigmatic to me. You know, look at the different aspects of it. So and what we worry about, why we have this in an emergency break glass constitutional provision, which of course, you know, undoes an election. That's what it's there for. So you have so many aspects kind of coalescing. You have the basic self-dealing and putting of personal base political interests over the interests of the nation, and not trivial interests at all, right? Really important strategic national security interests having to do with geopolitical balance in Europe and NATO and the like. That's really big. You know, all that that subordinated to trying to get an announcement that they're going after Biden. You have the invitation to foreign interference in the election, really big, the things that the framers cared about. You have the fact that, you know, in addition, it's all bogus. It's all, you know, manufactured. Everybody with, you know, who is credible has made it clear that the thing that Trump was trying to make a foreign country do was essentially, you know, lie or manufacture a claim. And then you have the various cover-ups and the fact that Rudy Giuliani was running foreign policy and the complete trammeling of the executive branch people who are there for it. It really is pretty hard. It's almost a law school hypothetical. What could be left to insert in terms of being in the heartland of why we have impeachability? And just to, you know, for example, think it's so much more serious than a personal crime. They've talked about DUI, but it's more serious than an assault. I think really it's far more serious than shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue as an impeachable offense. And then there's the fact that he's a recidivist, and it all happened the day after the Mueller report came out. And even to this day, you have, you know, Giuliani and Bill Barr, it would appear, continuing. So, in other words, it's a clear and present danger for our upcoming election, and wanting that to be without cloud and legitimate. So, man, you compare this with any aspect of a previous presidency, impeached or not, and I don't think anything comes close to it.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast. And he has an article at the Washington Post, "The Wait to See Trump's Taxes May Have Just Gotten a Lot Longer." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Police and thieves in the street. Oh, yes. Scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Stewart, the author of Tangled Webs, Heart of a Soldier, Blind Eye, Bloodsport, and the blockbuster Den of Thieves. He is currently a columnist for The New York Times and a professor at Columbia University School of Journalism. And in 1988, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the stock market crash and insider trading. And his latest book just out is Deep State, Trump, the FBI, and the Rule of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Stewart.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Well, thank you. And we're talking on a day, of course, when the impeachment of Donald Trump has become official.
Yes.
And much of course, the defense that we've heard from the Republicans, both in the hearings before the House Intelligence Committee and yesterday's hearings before the Judiciary Committee, are not that they specifically talk about the deep state, but they more or less are saying, you know, this is about a bunch of Democrats who hated this guy from day one, and they're using the kind of deep state actors to remove a duly elected president. The truth of the matter surely is, though, as much as progressives and liberals in this country want to get rid of Trump, wish there was a deep state that could do so, it just doesn't exist.
Not in the way that Trump has demonized and sort of weaponized the entire federal bureaucracy by branding it the deep state. You know, he has certainly in recent weeks and months turned particularly on the State Department and accusing them of being part of a deep state, you know, dismissing these various witnesses who have come forward with, in some cases, firsthand evidence about the Ukraine situation, saying, oh, they're all part of the deep state. They're just trying to overturn a democratically, you know, they're trying to overthrow a legitimate election. But in point of fact, you know, it is not a deep state in the traditional sense, which was, you know, came out of the mostly Middle Eastern countries where, you know, periodically the established, you know, to some extent government bureaucracy, but mostly private interests, the military, the old sort of industrial complex would step up and overthrow a leader, whether elected or dictatorial, it sort of didn't matter when their privileges were being threatened. In this case, we simply have public servants who are, in fact, carrying out their obligation, both under the Constitution and because they work for the American people. They do not work for the White House in our system of government, and they are simply coming forward and doing what I would call their patriotic duty by honestly testifying as to what they witnessed.
So do you think, though, that the case that is now before the Judiciary Committee, at least as much as we know, is built around the Ukraine case and the conversation between Zelensky and Trump, given the fact that it seems to be the Republican strategy is to sort of actually gin up hyperpartisanship, to be hyperpartisan in order to make it all seem like it is a partisan exercise. They're actually creating their own narrative in that sense, it would seem. And is it possible that there are other stronger cases that can be made or may be made? I mean, particularly, you've got those three cases now before the Supreme Court on Trump's taxes. And your book, of course, deals with Rosenstein and the confusion, the meltdown that happened when Comey was fired and a counterintelligence probe was begun. I don't know what the fate of that is, whether Barr has shut that down. But there are a lot of people in I was going to say in the deep state, a lot of people in the national security world say that the counterintelligence files that exist may well be really damaging to Trump. So that aside, do you think taxes, what's he most afraid of? Let me get to the point. What's he most afraid
of? Well, let me make a couple of points here. First of all, is there something worse? There potentially certainly could be. I think it's important to remember that Mueller did not get to the bottom of the Russia issues. I mean, he did go to the question of whether Trump himself colluded with the Russians to interfere with the election, and he found that there was not enough evidence. But we still don't know a great deal about what happened between Trump and the Russians, in many cases because the witnesses there were not available to Mueller, and he did not go beyond the somewhat narrow mandate of his probe. Another point I would make, before we even talk about whether there are other cases lurking there, the cases we already have, which include the obstruction of justice counts in the Mueller report, which I cover in great detail in my book, as well as now the attempts to get the Ukraine to launch these investigations, which Trump wanted to use in the 2020 election. One of the big Republican defenses is that these things were never consummated, that for example, Trump never actually fired Mueller, although he talked about him doing it many times, or in this case, that the aid to Ukraine ultimately was not withheld. And I think it's important for people to understand, I do happen to have a law degree, but I don't, not that you need to rest on that, but a conspiracy to obstruct justice does not have to succeed in order to be illegal. The attempt itself is against the law, and I think that the Republicans have fundamentally misstated the law in that regard. So I feel there is a very strong case that the president broke the law, did attempt to obstruct justice in both the Mueller probe and in the Ukraine situation. Now, that said, impeachment is a political affair. It's not a court of law. It's very separate from the traditional prosecutorial the apparatus that's available to prosecutors in the United States, and the Justice Department does have a policy that you can't charge a sitting president. So it's up for grabs. I mean, I can't speak to how the Republicans politically will deal with this, but from a legal standpoint, a clear case that the president broke the law is sitting right out there in front of us at this very minute.
And again, I'm speaking with James Stewart, the author of Tangle Webb's Heart of a Soldier, Blind Eye, Bloodsport, and the blockbuster Den of Thieves. He's currently a columnist for the New York Times and a professor at Columbia University School of Journalism. And in 1988, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the stock market crash and insider trading. And his latest book just out is Deep State, Trump, the FBI, and the Rule of Law. But is it more than a coincidence that the people that Trump seems most obsessed about are Comey, Clapper, and Brennan, and also the ones that he's effectively purged from the FBI, McCabe, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok, and Bruce Orr. In many ways, the latter are the core of the counterintelligence people on Russia, particularly on Russian organized crime. And the former DNI, the former head of the FBI, and the former head of the CIA are people that presumably know a lot about Trump's background. And I know it wasn't the writ of the Mueller report, but is any of that stuff ever going to see the light of day? I know books have been written about it.
I think so. I mean, first of all, I think it's extremely worrisome that the chief executive of the United States, the president of the United States, has turned the machinery of the Justice Department and aimed it squarely at the FBI, the premier federal investigative agency, and in some cases at members of the Department of Justice itself. And Trump has gone so far, as I point out in my book, to accuse people like Comey, Andrew McCabe, Lisa Page. He's accusing these people of treason, even when reminded that treason in this country does carry the death penalty. I mean, he has taken this to that much of an extreme. And all of these people either are or have been under investigation for doing what I believe to be was their patriotic duty. That's not to say that no one never makes a mistake, but that they were doing their best to carry out their obligations under the Constitution, their obligations to the American people, and their reward has been to be vilified by the president, in some cases in the crudest terms imaginable, to be branded traitors and to have to defend themselves now against ongoing federal investigations. Now, this is not just bad for them personally. It has ruined morale at these agencies, which were, you know, some of the crown jewels of American government. I can only imagine how it is affecting recruiting. Who would want to go into the FBI when, in return for doing your job, you're at risk of being branded a traitor? It's incredibly that Trump doesn't seem to realize that people must be investigated before you know they're guilty. You can't only investigate the guilty. In my view, he should have thanked them for their service, thanked Mueller for delivering the report he did, declared victory, and gone away. Instead, he's made it open war, and we now have ongoing investigations of the law enforcement people in this country. And I believe that is unprecedented.
Well, when you say crude, nothing was more crude than what he said recently about Lisa Page at a rally, which actually prompted her to go public.
I know. I mean, I can only imagine trying to put myself in her shoes. I mean, she was a relatively low-ranking civil servant. I mean, she was a general service grade 15 person. Nobody knew who she was. And she's relatively young. She's trying to raise a family. She's trying to hold her marriage together. She's trying to have a job. And she has the president of the United States at a major rally describing her in the crudest, most hostile, most misogynistic terms imaginable. The president of the United States, putting all of this aside, whether you like his policies, you don't like his policies, that we would have a president that would sink to that level is unfathomable. And he's holding it out, I think, as an example to others who would dare to cross his path or dare to uncover information that he doesn't want or to launch an investigation that he finds personally threatening. I just want to say one other point here, too, because how do innocent people typically react when they come under investigation? I mean, Obama was investigated for all kinds of things. Hillary Clinton was investigated for Benghazi, for the email scandal. They did not turn around and accuse the Justice Department and the people who were charging them as being traitors, or to try to turn around and make their accusers the issue. They defended themselves with the evidence. Now, Trump's attempt to change the subject and say, oh, it's not about me, it's about this is a witch hunt, this is a hoax, Comey was out to get me. Comey's out, you know, they're politically biased. This is not a new tactic. This is what people who either are guilty or who have a great deal of evidence against them typically do when they want to divert attention from themselves. It's what O.J. Simpson did in his trial successfully. And there have been many, many other attempts that were not successful.
Well, your book talks about the extraordinary pain that went on. You mentioned Lisa Page trying to save a marriage. My God, the President of the United States revealing an affair that she had with Peter Strzok, that had to be devastating.
Well, yes. I mean, this was all part of, an Inspector General investigation called for by the White House and by Republicans to look into whether there was any political bias in the prosecution of the Hillary email case. And the Inspector General put out an extremely voluminous report saying there was no political bias, even though there were some inflammatory texts from both Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. Their affair had nothing to do with this. They, in fact, were assured by the Justice Department that the affair was not going to be made public. What happened is the Justice Department called reporters in and showed them the text and disclosed the affair in an unprecedented, I don't know if you'd call it a leak. It's hard to call it a leak when it was done so openly, but they did this before the texts were turned over to Congress. And of course, in no time at all, this showed up in the Washington Post with devastating personal consequences to them. So the way this has been conducted from the beginning has given it a highly partisan cast, in which the Justice Department and specifically the Inspector General seem to have been used to weaponized almost to further Trump's view that, oh, all these people in the bureaucracy were out to get me.
Well, just in the last minute, though, isn't it an irony, though, that if you polled the rank and file of the FBI, I would think a majority of them Republicans and probably even a majority voted for Trump.
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, look, I'd be the first to say that, there's no litmus test for working for the FBI. I mean, if you work for the FBI, you have the right to vote for whoever you want. You have the right to support whoever you want. You can even put up a sign in your yard supporting someone. What you can't do is allow it to interfere with your professional duties. But I think there's no question that both currently and in the past, law enforcement generally and the FBI and specifically attracts people who want to see law and order, and typically they have been of a more conservative stripe. And one thing that I do disclose in the book that, they searched through text messages looking for anti-Trump bias. They did not look through anybody's text messages to find anti-Clinton bias. And there was a hardcore group of FBI people who were extremely hostile to Clinton and were doing everything they could to bring her down, including what appears to be systematic leaks of information to none other than Rudy Giuliani. So, people wonder, well, why did James Comey reveal that the email investigation was being reopened just 6 days before the election? Some people blame him for getting Trump elected. The truth is that he knew if he didn't reveal it, these anti-Clinton people inside the FBI would have leaked it, and that would have even been worse. It would have come out through a leak, and it would look like he was trying to cover it up. So he really had no choice but to make that disclosure.
Well, James Stewart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Stewart, the author of Tangle Webb's Heart of a Soldier, Blind Eye, Bloodsport, and the blockbuster Den of Thieves. He's currently a columnist for The New York Times and a professor at Columbia University School of Journalism. And in 1988, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the stock market crash and insider trading. And his latest book just out is Deep State, Trump, the FBI, and the Rule of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
need, folks. Politic needs your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic needs lives.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Maria Victoria Murillo, who is a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Latin American Studies at Columbia University, whose research focuses on electoral behavior, labor politics, education reform, agricultural policies, and economic policy in Latin America. And she has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times with Stephen Levitsky, The Return of the Generals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maria Victoria Murillo.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it is a very paradoxical world that we're in at the moment, where a lot of people are now depending upon or wanting the military to intervene against oppressive governments to rescue their own people. Now, it's happening before our eyes, for example, in Iran. And, of course, our president, who is woefully ignorant and frighteningly dangerous, at the NATO conference was asked whether he supports the people in Iran demonstrating against the government and being shot down in the streets by the Revolutionary Guards Corps. And he said no. And then his aides had to say to him, no, that was the wrong answer. And then he comes back and says, I thought you meant, should we be supporting them financially? Well, when has anybody ever paid a bunch of spontaneous demonstrators to go out and demonstrate, unless it's some kind of dictatorship? Or like the Iranian government does, has this the Basij militia, who are these fanatics that go out and beat up people. So you've got Iran as an example of the lot of people wanting, and including the Iranian people, wanting the military to step in and rescue them from the militias controlled by the reactionary religious theocratic leaders. The same is also happening in Venezuela, to the extent that people have been hoping that somehow the military will end the agony where this country is being destroyed by this incredibly incompetent, corrupt narco government, where you've got certainly a third of the country, third of the population has actually left the country, and I think it may be even higher than that now, and people are dying from lack of medicine and food, and it's a complete catastrophe. So there's two examples of where there is a sense that the military are the last people who can rescue, people from despotic governments. But your article is a warning that let's not go too far with this. So with that long introduction, give us your shorthand version of what you're arguing in your op-ed in Monday's New York Times.
So there are different things. So the point that the op-ed make is that what happened in Bolivia has been a military coup, even if the administration of Evo Morales was ruling in a way that was unconstitutionally by ignoring the result of a plebiscite that did not allow him to run again. And that bringing military as kind of the arbiters of the situation has a long tradition in Latin America in general and in Bolivia in particular that has not led to democratic outcomes. And so in general, what it has led, with these coups against populists had led to reactions and very revanchist governments that have polarized the situation more. And so in many cases, we've seen a lot of political instability. We bring the case of Argentina in the post-1955 period, when a coup ends the tenure of General Perón, who was elected president, was also ruling in a, moving away from democracy in the way he ruled. But the coup didn't bring democracy. It just bring another authoritarian regime, but a period of, coups, elected president, coups, elected president, that has been called like an impossible game. So it's not until 1983 that Argentina returns to an effective democracy. And so what we're pointing to is to the idea that the military as a very, very bad solution to problems of instability. And I think in most cases, the ideal solution is to have the international community and a process of negotiation that goes through institutional mechanisms of succession. And I think that's true in the case of Bolivia. The current administration has derogated the decree that we mentioned, had allowed the military to basically have carte blanche in killing people from protests. And I think that's a great move. But the society has become very polarized and divided. And so it's not clear, even if election happens, what would be the type of political regime that emerge. I mean, I really hope it's a democratic regime and one that allows all parties to run and be represented, not like what happened in Argentina post-85 when the largest party was not allowed to be part of the political system. So that's a case, and that's something that we are warning. And we're warning because we see across the region a moment of a lot of instability, a lot of protest, and many countries resorting to the military. In fact, Pompeo, Secretary Pompeo even like said, you know, this is all part of a conspiracy and, you know, we would be helping repressing the protest in these countries. And we're afraid that this is the language that comes back to a period that was very bad in Latin America where, you know, any kind of political unrest was reinterpreted in the light of the Cold War and served to come to bring the military repress and end with democratic administrations. And so we do think that, you know, we need to be cautious and ideally not rely in the military. The case of Venezuela is a very difficult one. And my fear in the case of Venezuela is that it might end in a civil war. I mean, we see lately the government arming not the military, but paramilitary forces, right? These colectivos. And so my fear is that you would have a situation that resembles more a civil war even than a military coup. And it's not clear where that lead the country, which is in a very bad situation now.
And again, I'm speaking with Maria Victoria Murillo, who's a professor of political science and the director of the Institute for Latin American Studies at Columbia University, whose research focuses on electoral behavior, labor politics, education reform, agricultural policies, and economic policy in Latin America. And she has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times with Stephen Levitsky, The Return of the Generals. And I agree with you. The situation in Venezuela is tragic and could even get worse. And Maduro's government is arming the colectivos. And so far, you know, Juan Guaido, with the support of Pompeo and Pence, etc., has been trying to encourage the military to turn against the government, but that hasn't worked, obviously. And when you mentioned the early examples of military coups, particularly in Argentina and also in Chile as well, the record there, of course, was so grim. I don't know whether you've seen this new movie, The Two Popes, but it's about the current pope who comes from Argentina, and it touches on the hideous military junta that murdered and disappeared so many of the people in such gruesome ways. I just saw it recently. It's just absolutely some of the most horrifying activities that you can imagine in what seems to be on the surface a very civilized country. So the history is so bad. So how do we thread this needle?
So, as you say, I mean, I'm originally from Argentina, and I do remember the days as a kid of the military regime. So, it is a difficult situation, and I think part of the reason why the military had become for some sectors an option is because of the volatile international situation. There's not any more clear consensus that push for democracy. So there are sanctions in Venezuela, but the sanctions are very, they hurt the population, but they don't hurt the government, who's still selling oil. And of course, you know, there are certain countries in the world that help and buy that Venezuelan oil. And so given the kind of very unstable world situation where nobody seems to be, you know, having a consensus that democracy is the way to go, where the United States is fighting with the other advanced countries, it's a situation in which it's almost like nobody's paying attention. When the coup happened in Bolivia, it was, you know, countries like Spain that normally pay attention, that it was going through its own election that very Sunday. So there is a sense in which both there is a high degree of polarization within the countries, and also a lack of external incentives to move in a situation that's more stable and to keep, you know, the institutions working as expected. So in some countries where the population has more of such a consensus, it is easier to keep the rules of the game. So you see the case of Uruguay. So that was a transition from a left-wing government to a right-wing government, which, you know, by less than 1%, and that caused no protest, no conflict. You know, it just happened through the rules of the game. That's very different from, you know, the situation that we're seeing in other countries of the region, when they're like the Bolivian situation, when the result of the election is contested, where people go into the streets and do not agree in what is that had happened. So again, we don't have either domestic, in some cases we do have domestic consensus, in other cases we don't, and at the international level there's not such a clear consensus, and most countries react to all of these events based on their domestic politics. And so the Bolivian case is a nice case in that, you know, countries, whether they were on the left or on the right in the government, either denounced the military coup or said it was a liberation, rather than looking at, okay, what shall we do? A majority of countries didn't do that. What shall we do to get, you know, Bolivia to continue with its process and coming to having a democratically elected president?
Well, how do you factor what you and Steve Levitsky have written about the return of the generals into this global phenomenon that you sort of vaguely touched on? You've got people around the world who are just fed up with their governments, whether they're left-wing governments or right-wing governments, in Chile and in Iraq, where they're getting shot down, in Iran, where they're fed up with their government, in Lebanon. All around the world, there's so much anger and distrust at governments. And is there, you know, the United States being the world's oldest enduring democracy, I'm not sure that we're setting the example. And particularly when you've got Trump, you know, being sympathetic to dictators like Putin, Xi, Duterte, Erdogan, and Bolsonaro in Brazil, is there anything that can be done in terms of when people get fed up, that you can return to a better form of democracy? Because obviously when conditions get bad, as you know, people can vote against their own interests, as they did here in the United States in voting for somebody that said he was a populist and was going to take care of the working people, but ended up turning around and giving away the store to the richest of rich Americans.
So let me first do a clarification. Regardless of what one thinks about Bolsonaro, he has been a democratically elected president. I would not call him an authoritarian, even though he's, you know, his discourse, it's moving in a direction, and some of his policies regarding the rule of the law are moving in a direction that certainly I disagree and I find worrisome. I think that Brazil is a democracy now, and so I think it's important to clarify that, because if we call every country or government we do not like authoritarian, that's when, you know, you can call the military and everything sounds democratic. So I think we should have certain rules, and there are certain rules that are defined to classify governments, and those should be used regardless of who was elected as president or prime minister in that particular case. That being said, I think there is a crisis of representation around the world, which is not the first time it has happened. We've seen these waves, for instance, in the 1960s, and now we're seeing a wave that's associated with problems of growth, with like a slowdown of the economy in cases like France, like Lebanon, like Iraq, like even Hong Kong, and certainly all of the Latin American cases. And so there is kind of the confluence of two different effects. On the one hand, there is a level of expectation that was created in particular during the period of high growth that suddenly cannot be met. And so the citizenship is unhappy. One thing is to tolerate guys that didn't seem to be working so well, but, you know, the pie was growing and we're all getting better with the expectation of getting better. That expectation has dramatically declined now. And the second aspect is that there is a crisis of representation in political parties, political organizations, and even the state. And so to the extent to which voters do not feel that they can, you know, vote for an alternative option or cannot organize through existing channels of representation, they're more likely to, you know, use extra institutional channels, like be desperate and go into the streets. We saw that in the case of Chile. I think we're seeing the same in the case of Colombia. And in many of these cases, it's really a reflection of the distrust on existing political parties as a mechanism to represent the people. And this is complicated in the sense that for the government it's also harder to negotiate, harder to articulate demands when you do not have someone on the other side that tells you very clearly, okay, we're mobilizing because we want X, and if you give X, we will not mobilize anymore.
Really appreciate you joining us. It's a very interesting discussion, and we should pick it up again, okay?
Thanks to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Maria Victoria Murillo, who's a professor of political science and the director of the Institute for Latin American Studies at Columbia University, whose research focuses on electoral behavior, labor politics, education reform, agricultural policies, and economic policy in Latin America. She has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times with Stephen Levitsky, The Return of the Generals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, the headline written down in a minute.